You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 57. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today I've got for you an interview I did with Marty Bent. But I just wanted to go ahead and kind of upfront apologize. I tried a different recording technique, and I should have used my other one as a backup, and I didn't. So Marty's side of the conversation sounds great. He had a good mic. I was using a different setup that was not my norm, and so my side is kind of sounds crappy. So I just wanted to say I'm aware of that, and I kind of did what I could to clean it up, but it still sounds a little crummy. So just bear with me, because Marty's side is the more important side anyways, and that's the side that sounds good. So, all right, without further ado, here we go.
Marty, welcome.
Josh, thank you for having me back on the podcast. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, man. You and I got together at Bitwalk Boom last year. That was a lot of fun. Kind of seems like a long time ago now already, but yeah. So what's new for you? You got a couple new things going on. You're dad now, and then you've got this Great American Mining thing going.
Yeah, I mean, even though 2020 is a pretty chaotic year so far, in a geopolitical and humanity sense for me, it's been pretty good. I mean, yeah, I had the birth of my firstborn. In February, and that's been incredible. Getting to know him and getting used to being a father, it's pretty fun. Even though you don't sleep that much, is what I'm finding out.
Just like give it up.
Yeah, and then so we've sort of come out of quasi stealth mode with GAM, with Great American Mining, and that's just been fun. Spreading that word and building that out and letting people know what we've been up to and what we're doing and what we want to do moving forward.
So when did all this start for you? You're saying coming out of stealth mode, like when did y'all start this stuff up?
It's actually funny. We made a lot of mistakes along the way. So I came into the company a little later than when the journey of GAM started, probably a few months after it started. And so in like the bull run of 2017 during the mania, the founder of GAM, Todd, he also runs a advertising platform, a digital advertising platform that's been very successful for the last 12 years. He bootstrapped it, and so he's been very profitable with that. And just the nature of that business, he got exposed to and introduced to cryptocurrency publishers and websites that were looking to sell advertisers get advertisements on their sites to make some money. And a few of the publishers demanded that they get paid in Bitcoin. And so Todd had to figure out how to make that happen. And then actually Roger Ver, we did some stuff for Bitcoin.com before the fork wars and all that, demanded that Todd hold the Bitcoin that he was receiving for the ads, and that sort of led him to actually holding Bitcoin. And you know, obviously, with what was going on in the 2017 bull run, he noticed that holy crap, there may be something here. And the first thing he thought was let's get into mining. Let's figure out how to actually acquire this Bitcoin directly. So he started his journey there. We actually made, again, like I said, we made a bunch of mistakes along the way. Bought some dragon mints first at like the height of the bull market in 2017, which is, if you're in mining, you know, that's probably the worst time to buy hardware and try to deploy it. But for the last 2.5-3 years, we've been on a journey trying to figure out how to make mining work for us. And so we've learned a lot along the way, and particularly what you learn is that you want to have the cheapest energy source and cheapest CapEx and OpEx that you can. And so that's what we've been looking for the last however many years. And in August of last year, we finally settled on what we're going to do, and which is this sort of waste of gas model where we get ourselves on oil fields and use their waste of gas that would otherwise be vented or flared and actually turn that into Bitcoin. Don't turn the gas into Bitcoin, or run the gas through generators that that run are connected to Bitcoin miners, containers with Bitcoin miners in them. And we mine Bitcoin on site and help the oil and gas producers mitigate wasted gas flare and vent.
You said in 2017, y'all bought a bunch of Dragon Mints. Were the Dragon Mints even shipping at that point? I'm trying to remember. They were like, it was a big deal to come on the scene. I remember at some point it was a big deal. Like Dragon Mint was coming online. And the whole thing was like to break the Bitmain monopoly.
Yeah. So we got into the first order of those. They did eventually ship. But I don't know how, they weren't very profitable. and two, we were very naive when we first got into this. Todd was. He thought you were going to be able to daisy chain miners and plug them into walls and make them work, and quickly realized that wasn't the case. And so that's what sent us on our mad dash for cheap and abundant energy. We don't use Dragon Mints today. We're using Watts Miners M20Ss. So a far superior machine in our opinion.
Kind of go into that. Like you talked about the CapEx and the OpEx and you know, my understanding, I had a friend who knew that I was a Bitcoin guy, and he was a engineer and into hardware of different kinds. And so we kind of played around with the miners for a bit, but then he got busy with another project. And you know, the kind of the thing that I saw is there's the margins are pretty thin, and so any kind of little efficiency or whatever you can eke out makes a difference. And a lot of people kind of keep any differences or discoveries that they make pretty close to the chest. Like, what are the different variables that go into that?
Yeah, there's many variables. To miner specifically, you got to time the market of when you buy the hardware. It's a very reflexive market to the price of Bitcoin. So, and the price of the hardware is actually pretty volatile as well. So you try to catch the hardware purchasing when prices are low for the miners. That's one variable. Another is what miner you do buy, decide on. S9s obviously have been the most successful hardware on the market to date, and they've lasted for quite some time, still running today, and there will be some running after the halving. And the reason that is because some miners have figured out how to find, number one, cheap gas that allows them to mine profitably still even after the halving. If the closest you get your energy prices to zero, the more success you're going to have actually mining Bitcoin with those machines after the halving. And then on top of that, people have been operating S9s particularly for long enough know that you can overclock them, underclock them, and sort of work at the firmware level to eke out more efficiencies. That's another area where you try to eke out some efficiencies at the firmware level, sort of discovering the limits of the machines themselves and how you can tweak them to get as many terahashes as possible. Then beyond that, you want everything around the miners to be as cheap as possible. So we just try to cut the price of our containers and all the electrical engineering inside them as low as possible. And that has led to us actually building our own containers and building our own PDUs even. We're finding that that's helping us cut cost. And then energy obviously is one of the biggest costs. One of the biggest price cost variables in the whole equation. So just trying to get that as low as possible as well.
You mentioned the halving, and just for somebody is new listening and you're not aware of what the halving is, it's kind of a big deal coming up here in a week and a half, but the mining reward cuts in half. And it's not a gradual thing. It's just like suddenly from one block to the next that the mining reward cuts in half. And there's a lot of speculation on how that affects different things, but yeah, the reward of what you're getting per block goes down.
Yeah, yes, particularly the subsidy. So it's going to get cut from 12.5 Bitcoin to 6.25, and then the fees make up the other part of that reward. And actually, so like right now, where the price is, it has nothing to do with price, probably more congestion of the network. Fees are making up 7.72% of blocks, according to Clark Moody's dashboard. And that's actually significantly higher than it was this time last week. So if there's fee pressure in the market, it can certainly help make up for some of the loss of revenues due to the block subsidy cutting in half.
So let's kind of broad overview, like why does mining matter for Bitcoin, like for the security of the chain? And then why does it matter to like have it here in America or even have it in diverse geographical regions?
Yeah, well, I mean, mining matters very much so because it's what makes Bitcoin. It's one of the variables and one of the parts of the network that makes it work. Without mining, it really wouldn't work too well. It is a proof of work distributed peer-to-peer cash system. So yeah, mining, what do miners do? They're all attempting to solve a hash function, SHA-256 specifically, and they're looking to find a hash below the current difficulty target. Once they do, they're able to, while they're looking for that hash, they're constructing blocks of transactions in the background. And once they find that hash, they're able to present a block to the network if it is within consensus rules, whatever the consensus is at any given point in time. It can be accepted and then propagated across the network. And how do miners secure or protect Bitcoin? Once a transaction is confirmed, miners building on top of that block where your transaction is confirmed sort of add certainty for you that your transaction has gone through and will still be verified by the chain going forward and be recognized in the ledger as having gone through. So after X amount of blocks, you can have a certain degree of certainty that your transaction has gone through and will not be reversed. And the more hash power that is mining, the harder it is to sort of reverse those transactions that have been confirmed. So the more hash power on the network, the harder it is and more expensive it becomes, especially if the price of Bitcoin is increasing, to sort of reverse and replace transactions.
And then, you know, there's been this, I think there's a lot of FUD that gets thrown around, and there's maybe some truth to it, or has been in the past, that like, oh, mining is all centralized in China. And if, you know, the Chinese government wanted to, they can step in and seize it, you know, all these mining operations. And maybe they have, who knows? And that, you know, because of that, Bitcoin's not really secure because it's all centralized in China. What would you say to that?
That was certainly true at one point in time. It wasn't all in China, but vast majority of mining was in China, and still a material considerable amount is, depending on who you talk to. It's anywhere from 40% to 70%. More miners in the know that I've been speaking with recently think it's on the lower side of that estimate. I think it's important to bring hash rate to North America specifically, because number one, as a Bitcoiner, you want hash rate to be distributed geographically. So you want it to be happening in as many places as possible, just in case one of those places gets attacked, or if China, having a very material amount of the hash rate within its borders, if the CCP steps in one day and forces all the Chinese citizens running Bitcoin mines to unplug their operations, you don't want 60% of the network being located there. So from a Bitcoiner's perspective, it's, hey, we want to get this distributed outside of China. Let's bring as much hash rate over here to America as possible to help the network become more distributed. And then as an American, I think it's important because I believe that Bitcoin will be a very crucial and important technology in monetary or in network moving forward. And I think it makes a lot of sense for America to have skin in that game. And so I think the more entrepreneurs and companies that we have looking at Bitcoin and working to build out physical infrastructure to make it go around, the better. That's why I actually like what we're doing at GAM, because we're approaching entrepreneurs and companies and not the government, convincing them that they should mine Bitcoin because it actually helps their businesses. It's not even an altruistic endeavor for Bitcoin. I mean, to some extent it is, but the incentives for the oil companies, it makes sense for them to mine Bitcoin. You don't even have to convince them of Bitcoin's value proposition or what it stands for, or what it may mean for the future. It actually just solves a huge problem that they have and will continue to have moving forward, which is waste gas when they produce the oil. And that's a problem that they need to solve. And Bitcoin just so happens to solve it much better than any of the alternatives that exist on the market today.
Okay, so go into that a little bit. Like, what is this problem with the waste gas? Because I kind of know a little bit about it just from friends who, went into petroleum engineering and some of that kind of stuff. But, kind of what are you seeing, and what is this problem that Bitcoin solves for them?
Yeah, so when you poke a hole in the ground to extract oil, oil is not the only thing that comes out. You have a bunch of gases that come out with that as well, mainly methane. And it's like the amount of gas that comes out is pretty staggering, pretty stunning when you actually begin to look into how much is coming out of the ground. And so that's obviously very bad for the atmosphere. And obviously we live in a world where people are hyper-conscious about the climate and the environment. And so to mitigate that sort of pollution, if you just poke a hole in the ground, extract the oil and let the gases float up the atmosphere, it's much worse for the environment than if you were to actually do something with that gas. The problem is it's hard to do stuff with that gas. What you find is oil and gas producers mainly flare it, which is they just set up huge flares, stack flares on site, and they light a fire and just run the gas through that flare and burn it because it's a little bit less bad for the environment. So they're trying to help in that way. There are other alternatives, one being you create a pipeline and try to transport that gas to market to sell it to people, but that's due to natural gas prices and the cost of building the physical infrastructure of the pipelines. That's cost prohibitive and not very profitable, if at all. And then another alternative they have is something called natural gas liquids, where you bring equipment on site, similar to what we do with the Bitcoin miners, but instead of running it through a generator and mining Bitcoin, you run it through this compression process and turn it into a liquid that you then put in a bunch of trucks and transport to the market to be sold. But that is also not very profitable. So
yeah, and now you're paying for gas for trucks to drive it somewhere else and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And so these oil and gas producers are between a rock and a hard place, where they want to get the oil. Up till about a month ago, getting the oil and selling it on the market has been very profitable for them, or a month and a half now at this point. And in some states, depending on where you are, the regulations around venting and flaring are either very loose or very strict. And so we looked for places where the regulations are very strict and you have what's called like a vent or a flare cap that these producers are supposed to meet. After they flare X amount, they have to shut down oil production until for the month or whatever it may be, for a certain period of time. And their incentive is to keep oil production up and running pretty consistently. And so they're just looking for ways that they could capture that gas and either sell to the market or have it consumed so that they can keep oil production going.
You know, even without having like the value of the Bitcoin that's generated or sold or whatever, for them, it's a benefit because it means they can get more oil out of the ground.
Precisely. Yes. That's all they care about. it's a win-win-win all around in our mind, because we're able to find very cheap energy, free energy. Basically, their problem's so large that they're just giving it to us. Wow. And if oil prices hit a certain price, go back to where they were a few months ago, we may even find ourselves where they're willing to pay us to take it. So you get it to like negative prices there. And it's another win too, because if you were to build a pipeline and and sort of try to sell this gas to market. There's more problems that come with that because you don't know the quality of the gas before you poke the hole in the ground. And so you have varying levels of cleanliness and dirtiness in the gas. So we actually consume a lot of what's considered dirty gas, has a high BTU level. The generators that we're using are able to sort of chug that without many problems. And so we're able to consume dirty gas for them, which would be harder to treat if you were to try to send it down a pipeline or do NGL, and get rid of that for them pretty immediately on site.
Cool. What was I going to say about the business side of it? You were talking about not doing this altruistic thing and not going to the politicians, going to the businesses. Do you think that this, when you say that, my mind goes to, like it or not, there is a big lobby for oil and gas, right? And so if you make Bitcoin a desirable thing for the oil and gas guys, for me, I see that as maybe being a better way to protect Bitcoin from the politicians than trying to lobby the politicians directly with a bunch of computer nerds.
Yeah, no, it's actually one of our theses as well. And I've said this on a couple of other podcasts. So yeah, you get the oil and gas companies sort of invested in. And right now it's very early on in this game with the oil and gas industry, particularly. They don't even really know that we're mining Bitcoin. We're just a flare mitigation service for them. We have data centers on site, quote unquote data centers. There's boxes that sit in their fields and people come and look at them. Are like, what the hell's going on in there? But yes, eventually we do think our thesis is that the oil and gas companies will wake up to the fact that this is Bitcoin mining happening on their fields, and it's actually much more profitable than what they're currently doing and the alternatives that exist today. And it'll just, we've run the numbers from our sites that have been live for the last 6 months. It is materially more, it's actually profitable, very profitable. Again, the fact that we're consuming dirty gas that would probably not be able to be sold to the market is pretty insane that they're able to actually get value out of that in the form of mining Bitcoin, either liquidating it on the market or holding it. So our thesis is over the next 3 to 5 years, they're going to start retrofitting oil fields across the country, going to start retrofitting their fields with Bitcoin mining operations. And that's a huge investment that they have in their infrastructure. And so they'll just naturally be lobbying on behalf of Bitcoin on Capitol Hill because of the amount of money that they have sunk into this in the future. And so you don't even need a coin center or a HODL pack. You have one of the strongest lobbies in the world standing up for Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so let's kind of go into then, that's the kind of the backdrop, but now give us like what's currently going on since you kind of came forward with this, and what's going on in the oil markets, and then how does that affect you guys, and how does that affect your oil producers?
Yeah. So obviously with coronavirus, the economy is shut down, and country's been on lockdown for a few months now. So naturally, when you have economic activity grind to a halt, the demand for oil, for gas, for gasoline particularly, is going to fall dramatically. And so that has happened. The amount of oil that is demanded on the market over the last couple of months has fallen significantly. And because of that, you have backup in supply. So the oil producers continue producing oil and sending it down pipelines. And then when there's nobody to buy it on the other end, you have a supply glut. So basically what's happened and why the prices have crashed so much is because there's so much supply on the market that is not being met with any demand. And so you have a backup in supply that is oil and gas is extremely abundant at the moment. That's in a nutshell, that's what's happening in the oil market. So you've gotten to the point where even oil reserves, which are supposed to take oversupply, are full. You have tankers sitting out in the ocean, just filled with oil, waiting to deliver it somewhere. And until the economy gets back up and running, it's certain that demand is not going to catch up anytime soon. So until the economy gets back to some sense of normalcy, you'll probably see depressed oil prices unless countries like, well, another factor of this whole oil depression is the fact that OPEC, particularly Saudi Arabia, well, Russia came into an OPEC meeting and told OPEC that they were not going to cut production of oil. They were going to continue producing at the pace that they were. And I believe heading into that meeting last or in early March, it was basically the understanding of the market that Russia was going to play ball and cut production with Saudi Arabia and the rest of the world. And when that didn't happen, Saudi Arabia reacted by saying, all right, we're going to produce more. So you sort of had this compounding effect of the biggest oil producers in the world in a bitch fight. And they're trying to big dick each other by producing more as the economy is grinding a halt. So it's sort of a cascading effect of oversupply, economy grinding to a halt, and then increased oversupply because you have OPEC in a dick swinging war right now as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, how many people aren't driving around and all that stuff from the, you know, that's what you're talking about with the economy grinding to a halt. That's how that, you know, not a lot of people driving around, or far fewer people driving around, I guess. And other, you know, commercial uses of it as well. Yeah.
Yeah, flights are halted. People aren't driving to work. Biggest drivers of consumption of gasoline are sort of ground to a halt right now.
Yeah, yeah. So how does that affect you guys?
So luckily, the oil company we're partnered with is well capitalized and was well hedged.
My wife's waving hi.
Hey.
My wife said to say hi.
Hey, hey. So up to this point, I mean, we've been lucky. Who knows how long we'll stay lucky. We've lucked out with the oil company that we're working with, so our well pad is not shut in that we're on right now. And from what we understand, it'll be pretty profitable even at low oil prices. And it's an older pad that's just running on cruise control basically at this point. But yeah, I mean, a lot of, especially the shale industry here in America, has been decimated. A lot of oil fields are shutting in well pads, and some companies are shutting down and closing their doors because it's simply too much to handle. And another thing to take into consideration is the oil industry is very over-levered with debt, with oil prices being very high. 10 to 15 years ago, a lot of oil companies took out loans that basically said, hey, we're going to pay this back. And they projected the payback period. During the payback period, that oil prices would be, a lot of these loans said like $70 to $100 a barrel. And they're obviously, I don't know where they are today. I haven't checked the price of oil yet, but below $20, probably below $15 at the moment. And so you have that. A big problem as well. The oil industry is overlevered with debt. So as this crisis persists, you're going to see like a cascading sort of default throughout the industry. And you're going to see probably mass consolidation. And again, luckily, our partner has not experienced that up to this point. But who knows how long the economy will be shut down and how long it will take for, number one, the demand to come back to the market. Number two, the demand to chew for the supply that's already on the market. Number three, get back to a sort of equilibrium of supply and demand. Those are a few unknowns that exist out there, and that we just have to take into consideration and hope that our luck prevails. I mean, we're not betting on luck. We have contingency plans if things do go awry, but we would really like to stay where we are and help prove out this use case with the partner we're working with.
Yeah, it looks like WTI is $19.02 or something like that right now.
Yeah, so, right around 20. That's what I thought.
Yeah. And I've got family who previously worked in kind of a corollary to the oil and gas. They did tooling for oil and gas companies, and even they had this very fluctuating you know, business cycle. You know, things would be really, really good, and then things would crash and be really, really bad. Do you think? I mean, is there potential here if you get these oil companies in on the Bitcoin side of things, that that when the price crashes, if the Bitcoin price is right, that that kind of evens things out for them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's another one of our theses is that over time, Bitcoin will basically just be help set a floor on energy prices and in a better equilibrium. You won't have these drastic swings in overproduction and shut-ins due to the unknowns that come with supply and demand. Bitcoin mining provides a consistent demand that doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. If Bitcoin, the network survives into perpetuity, there's going to need to be miners into perpetuity. So that's a constant demand generator for energy consumption in general, not just oil or gas. And so if you retrofit all these oil fields with Bitcoin mining operations, they have the ability to either send that oil and gas to market or consume it on site to mine Bitcoin. And depending on the economics at any given point in time, they could do either or they will decide to do either or. And Bitcoin just provides a nice, easy alternative and helps get these companies out of a pretty hard place that they're in right now. Imagine if they were able to consume all the oil that's currently glutted up in reserves and stuff like that to mine Bitcoin. So that's one thing that has to be solved. Again, there's nuance in this. We're using gas, and consuming that gas uses specific generators. I'm not certain the type of generator that would be used like on site to consume that oil or how the oil needs to be treated. I'm more focused on the waste gas side up to this point. So that's something that I think it could be solved, but I don't know the answer to that directly at this moment.
Yeah. And what about things like, I mean, I don't know how it is in the jurisdictions that you guys are working in. I know, like down here in Texas, it's like natural gas is kind of like everywhere. So y'all are just doing like the flared gas off of the oil sites, right? Or are y'all doing any natural gas sites specifically?
Yeah, we're just doing waste gas at the moment, but we have been having more and more conversations with natural gas. People have been mining off of natural gas just straight from a well or from a pipe in a place that's abundant with that has abundant natural gas resources. Actually, I'm releasing a podcast on Tales from the Crypt next week with a gentleman named Marshall Holbrook, who's actually really innovating and has been innovating in that space. I think he's been running alone in that space for 5 years. He's got a bunch of properties in Kentucky where he finds natural gas wells that aren't being used, plugs miners into them, and is basically making money that way. Like he's been in the natural gas business for 20 years. He started when natural gas prices started plummeting. When fracking took off earlier this century, he had to find alternatives. In 2015, I believe he said, he started buying S9s or S7s at the time and plugging them in a little bit at a time to see if he could actually make money off Bitcoin mining. He thought he was only going to allocate like 10% of the gas that he was pulling out of the ground to this. And over time, it just became so obvious to him that it was more profitable to mine Bitcoin as opposed to build pipelines to service municipalities, that he's like 100% Bitcoin mining with the gas now. And so that does exist. We do not do it at GAM yet. We may do it in the future. We're exploring those options, but that's another area of the energy sector that is wide open for innovation with Bitcoin.
When are you guys going to build your own foundry?
I don't think we'll ever do that alone, but that's another part of our thesis with the oil and gas industry. So first you get them to invest in Bitcoin, they get their infrastructure built out, they go and stand up for Bitcoin at Capitol Hill because they have so much invested in it, and then they look at the hardware that is getting plugged into that infrastructure and they say, hey, this seems to be pretty concentrated in a very few areas that are not in the Western Hemisphere. Maybe we should lobby or invest to bring a foundry over here. So we think within 10 years, an initiative like that will happen if our thesis plays out. We're not going to, we will definitely be championing it. I don't know if we, Great American Mining as a company, are going to be building the foundry. That's not our expertise, but we do think, you know, a lot of people are skeptical, but we do think it will happen to some, we think it needs to happen at some point.
I think this whole thing with the, you know, supply chain so heavily dependent upon China, maybe in the long run might be good for us. You know, obviously there's a lot of pain in the short term, but I think bringing manufacturing back to America and stuff, and making people say, okay, I realize that it's more expensive if you produce things in America, but either maybe the quality is better, or it's a more secure way. You don't have to be dependent upon or subject to geopolitical events and, you know, black swan events like this.
Yeah. I think the Western world is waking up to this fact. I mean, we have most of our medicine produced in China, a lot of our electronics. But it's hard to say how it will play out. I think we should definitely try to move as much manufacturing as we can, and much of the supply chain as we can, onto American soil, just to have a protect us first mentality. But not to say we shouldn't take advantage of other supply chains outside the country in the future, but I do think we should have at least a base layer of infrastructure in place that allows us to subsist and succeed during crises like the one we're going through now.
Yeah. So what's next for you guys? I mean, I know that there's so much that's up in the air right now with all of this, but is there a next big project y'all are working on, or is it just kind of keep doing the same thing and ironing out the kinks and stuff?
Yeah, so it's been a very iterative process. We're definitely ironing out some kinks. Right now, we're focused on the next little bite that's been put in front of us to chew off. So we're gonna tackle that, which is a build that's four times bigger than what we've done up to this point. And so we're in the proving our thesis, ironing out the kinks, getting our CapEx costs as low as possible process. And most importantly, collecting the data from our projects that are currently live and using that data to go sell to other oil and gas companies. So we're going to perfect our process, prove out our thesis, and then go sell the dream to oil and gas producers across America.
Yeah. So what's the, what does the operation and the maintenance of this look like? I mean, both in terms of work and effort that goes into it, and expenses and things like that.
Yeah, that's where the design of the containers really comes into play and is really crucial. We're lucky that we have a very smart team. We have a chemical engineer on staff that really understands the type of gas we're consuming and the environment that the container is being dropped in. We're in North Dakota, and so we actually launched containers in negative 45 degree weather. Wow. this winter. Pretty successfully, and I think something that's provided us a huge advantage up to this point is our team and the intellectual capital that comes along with it. So again, we have a chemical engineer who's sort of designing the airflow through our containers and deciding which generators we should buy to consume the dirty gas that we're consuming, which has been a huge benefit having him on the team. Reed Browning is his name. And beyond that, so we have Austin Storms is on our team as well. He's a Bitcoiner, has been around for a while. He actually is one of the pioneers of the mining and shipping containers movement. He's been doing that for quite some time. So he's been designing the containers and the electronics within the containers since 2013, I believe. And I could be wrong on that date. Don't quote me on that. But he has been developing basically systems and software that allows you to tinker with these machines remotely. So that's a big thing that we have to focus on as we're ironing out these kinks and building out our operations, is we have to think one of the mindsets we have is like, all right, we're going to have to operate the stuff remotely. It's going to be disparately scattered throughout oil fields. We're going to be 100 miles away as a team. So we're building software and communications tools with the actual miners and the container to make sure that we're handling the fan speeds, the temperature, anything you could think of within the container and doing that remotely. We do have, with the oil company we're partnered with, we have made relationships with the local service providers on the oil field that we're working on. So we do have people that can go and fix machines and unplug them, replug them in if need be. And they can get there in like half an hour. But as we scale this up, it's not going to be incredibly easy to do to get physically to all the containers if you need to fix something. So we need to think and create software that allows us to do as much remotely as possible. So that's one thing we're thinking of and building out as well.
Cool. Well, then I just thought about, you know, when we were talking about both Bitcoin security and supply chains and all these things of, you know, in the future, if Bitcoin really takes off the way we're all hoping it does, and becomes, you know, the currency, or at least a huge player in the currency world, you know, there are definitely, like, in my mind, national security interests in having big mining operations, you know, in your country, right? Because you don't want other countries censoring your transactions or whatever. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of just rambling here, but to me, it makes sense on even just like a national security sense.
Yeah. Well, I think the important thing to hammer home here too is like, let the entrepreneurs do it. Like, let individual Americans, you don't need a government mandate. Like, the incentives of Bitcoin are so beautiful. This naturally just happening at a grassroots level, because Bitcoin's solving problems that need to be solved for capitalists and entrepreneurs. Like, we don't need the state to mandate that we bring X amount of hash rate to the states. The market is going to do that naturally. And as long as the government doesn't fuck it up, that's like my biggest worry, is that they just try to shut it down before it flourishes. So I think as long as outside of New York State, which has had the worst regulation around Bitcoin to date, I think everybody's hands-off approach is pretty good. Just hoping that continues and we can just build out infrastructure. And by the time that infrastructure is built out, it'll be too late to do anything. It'll be like, hey, some of your most pertinent industries are very dependent on this protocol. Like, how are you going to shut it down? Especially energy. When we talk about oil independence and energy independence a lot, Bitcoin helps us get to that point and secure that independence. So it doesn't make sense to shut it down. And hopefully the entrepreneurs are able to build out that infrastructure, improve that before the government can fuck it up.
Yeah. I wasn't saying that, you know, we should have like a government mandate amount of mining or anything going on. But yeah, that's my hope, is that maybe that's an argument to be made when lobbying just for, I guess, protection from overregulation in that sense.
No, I wasn't putting those words in your mouth. I was just...
No. Yeah, clarifying. Yeah. Oh, crap. I had another thought. Hang on.
No, one thing I can riff on too is, we think a lot of people are very pessimistic right now about the future of the country and the state of the economy and whether or not we'll get out of this rut caused by the lockdowns and the fiat monetary system. And I think Bitcoin, again, the incentives are perfect, and it's helping out these industries that most people wouldn't think of until you actually go out and prove that it actually helps. And I think it provides a very optimistic future and a very, we had the moon race in the 50s or 60s, whenever that was. When did we go to the moon? 69. Yeah, the moon race in the 60s. And this, you can have like a race to build out an infrastructure for Bitcoin, for a new monetary system enabled by entrepreneurs. Not even the space race was funded by the government. This could be funded by entrepreneurs and capitalists, and you could sort of naturally bring back a lot of industry to the country. There's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built out, and so I think Bitcoin provides a lot of optimism. And then secondary and tertiary effects of retrofitting the energy sector with Bitcoin miners really helps create energy security, number one, and then energy price stability as well, which is good for the economy overall and people that are building and consuming stuff overall. So I think that's a good goal to strive for. And a lot of people are very pessimistic right now. There's so many opportunities out there that Bitcoin does provide. And I'm eternally optimistic right now because I think it's going to change the world for the better. And I think it is happening. So turn those frowns for sure. Upside down.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the biggest things that keeps me coming back for Bitcoin is that I think prior to that, when I really started kind of digging into libertarianism and you know, realizing how jacked up the money was, it was really depressing because it just felt like, you know, and this is the problem I have with a lot of gold bugs is it's kind of dependent upon, like, this desire to return to a gold standard is kind of dependent upon some kind of apocalyptic meltdown, right? And it's like, Bitcoin is optimistic because you can just build it and you don't have to wait for something terrible to happen.
Exactly. And people are building it. It is happening. Blocks being produced roughly every 10 minutes. More and more people are buying it and asking about it. I just sent a tweet out. My 22-year-old sister texted me and asked me about the halving today. I've never been prouder of her in my life. But
nice.
And then it seems like we're rearing up for another little bull run here. Interest has definitely peaked, PIQUED, by many individuals around the world right now. So I think that bodes well. And hopefully they realize the optimistic nature of Bitcoin and the beautiful future can help provide humanity.
Yeah. Oh, I know, like, kind of the road I was going to go down. Like, what does it look like on the opposite, or I guess on the other side, like on the Bitcoin side for you guys? Are you, and I know that with mining, some of this stuff has to be kind of kept close to the chest. So if you can't talk about it yet, I get that. Are you guys still working under mining pools, or are you your own thing, or like, how does the sale on the other side of that go? Or how much are you keeping as far as Bitcoin, and how much gets sold off and things like that?
Yeah, I mean,
and you can be as general or specific as you're allowed to be about that.
Yeah, so up to this point, we've been self-funded. So we've been, and we're in an experimental phase. We've been holding most of the Bitcoin that we've been mining. But as we go out, we raise money and take money from investors and start building out this infrastructure. We plan on developing hedging strategies, whether it be in futures price markets, or there's even hash rate derivatives that are coming out. We're trying to measure the efficacy of those products particularly. So definitely have hedging strategies with our treasury and cash management. We are a business at the end of the day, and we have to make sure we're managing that. And as you can see from the oil industry right now, people have not managed their balance sheets well, have suffered pretty dearly. So we, number one, we got to take care of ourselves as a business. We plan on doing that via hedging in the markets and, again, driving that CapEx and OpEx down as low as possible. From a pool perspective, yeah, I mean, we're small at this point, so we don't even have enough hash rate to self-mine outside of a pool. So we're contributing to Slush Pool right now. That's subject to changes in the future. It's also something that the industry is going to have to figure out here in North America, is like, what pools are you allowed to contribute to? Like, how does that work? Is there any red tape there as you scale up? Maybe we've floated the idea of creating a North American pool in the future once we hit a greater scale, but that's a problem we'll attack down the road. It's not really a priority right now.
Yes. Do you, along that vein, do you foresee there being issues like, if you're mining in different states having different restrictions on the sales of that and stuff?
I mean, we just got to stay out of New York State at this point. So
yeah.
But even with that said, obviously there's actually a bunch of power coming on and a bunch of hash rate coming on in New York State. So I think it's still very much Wild West, which is good. I think, again, the states and the federal government should just take a step back and watch what's happening and sort of observe and probably never do anything because Bitcoin just works and it's helping individual citizens across the country and individual states. So one thing we do though is target states with stricter emissions regulations. So that that is not really directly connected to Bitcoin at all, but it benefits us as somebody's looking for cheap gas and producers with a higher incentive to get rid of that cheap gas.
Right. That makes sense. All right, man. Well, we're coming up on the hour mark here, so I want to be considerate of your time. Anything else you want to tell the listeners out there or make sure they know ways to keep up with what y'all are doing at Great American Mining?
Yeah, if you guys want to check us out, you can find us at gam.ai. That's GAM.AI. You can email me, marty@gam.ai. If you are interested in what we're doing, think you can help, are an oil and gas producer and are looking for solutions similar to what we're doing and are interested in talking about it. And then for listeners out there, yeah, I mean, that's the one thing we've been trying to, and why we've becoming more vocal in the last couple of months, because we truly believe that this is the future and it is very important that this happens. And so we're trying to be as vocal as possible, we're being more vocal now because we have the data. The data's in from our operations. Like, this works. It's more profitable. It makes sense. And so we're just trying to get that message out and spread it as far and wide as possible to help wake people up to the fact that Bitcoin actually fixes this. And it's good for entrepreneurs, capitalists, American citizens, Bitcoiners. It's a win-win-win all around in our mind. And so we're just trying to help educate people about that and spread that message. So if you agree with what we're saying and you're having conversations about Bitcoin and energy markets with your friends and family, let them know what we're doing. Go to our Twitter page. We've got videos of our operations on Twitter. You can share that with your family and friends and say, hey, this is happening right now. It's pretty straightforward. The economics are definitely better. It's better for the environment. It's better for energy security, for energy independence, for price stability, unless we're crazy and are completely missing something. This works, and it works really well.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for coming on, and hopefully, you know, all this lockdown stuff will ease up soon and we can get together again in real life.
No, I can't wait to meet. I don't know, maybe it won't be Texas, wherever it is. Sit down, chat Bitcoin.
Yeah, man. All right. Take care.
See you, man.
All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that interview. It was a lot of fun. I think this is a really important topic. I think mining in America is going to be a big deal. We just have to figure out how to make it work. So it's good that there's a few groups working on that. And from conversation there, it sounds like there may be some other groups beyond the big players that we know about. So cool to see that taking off. And you know, I think I want all countries to get along, right? But that's probably not realistic. And so I think if we can get something going where as a country we can secure an advantage or even just have something that helps to secure our place, right? Maybe it doesn't mean that we're putting ourselves above others or whatever, but at least we're keeping pace. And, you know, Marty made a good point here that we want private companies doing this, we don't want government necessarily stepping in and doing that, although I have kind of some thoughts that at some point they might, but that's kind of beyond the point here. So anyway, all of that said, go check out, if you don't listen to Tales from the Crypt already, like, what are you doing? Go check out Marty's show. He does a lot of great interviews, and then once or twice a week, he and Matt Odell do the Rabbit Hole Recap, where they talk about the news of the week and all kinds of stuff. So I kind of have a hard time believing that you're listening to this show and you don't listen to his, but if for some reason that's the case, go listen to that podcast. He's also got the newsletter, and Marty's Bent comes out weekdays, so more of his thoughts and musings on all things Bitcoin. and then of course Great American Mining. So I'll have links in the show notes to all of those sites and Twitter feeds and whatnot. And like you said, if you're someone who wants to get involved in that some way, reach out and let them know. All right, per usual, share the show, subscribe so you don't miss the next episode, and follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC. If you want to go to bottomshelfbitcoin.com and look around, that'd be cool. I am going to be working on kind of updating it. It's been sorely neglected. So hopefully there will be, with school wrapping up and things like that, then hopefully I'll have some time to work on that and make it presentable. But no promises. All right. For Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.